Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
However, standing by right now is the one and the only, Sean Mooney.
Who? Mooney. Everybody's got a price for the $1 million man.
After you threw him off through the announce table, Taker climbs back down, he gets in the ring, and he goes, see if he's breathing.
So right before I called 911, I thought she'd fallen asleep. Kind of shook her a little bit to wake her up, and she did not respond.
And I'll go to my grave, testifying or whatever, swearing that Davey was not on drugs. If he was on drugs, the way Brett says, how great does that make Davey?
Are you laughing, Sean?
I get off the track here all the time.
Did you just laugh, Sean?
If they would do a movie about your life, who would you want to play your part?
Well, George Clooney, of course. Who else could it be?
Attention, Sean Mooney, you scum, you slime, you maggot. If there's no further questions, you're dismissed. Carry on, maggot.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of PTSM. I'm your host, Sean Mooney. We chatted with Joey Ryan, a very controversial individual in the world of professional wrestling. It's hard not to make dick jokes when you talk about Joey Ryan, but clearly he had the balls to make it in the business. I know, I went there. And Joey has a huge following now. I did it again. But really, despite, you know, all the purists out there who condemn him, it's an outrage what he's doing. There are many, many big names in the business right now who like what he's doing, among them Cody Rhodes and the Young Bucks. So Joey Ryan's star is definitely rising. And above all, I really appreciate his uniqueness. He is definitely an individual who has paid his dues. And he's found a gimmick that works for him, and he's going to keep working hard. I know, that was too easy. But really, though, I for one, like what Joey Ryan is doing out there and love the fact that he really doesn't care what other people think as far as it affecting what he does in the ring. And really, I want to thank Joey for coming on. All righty, another great guest this week on the podcast. He is an individual that I didn't know, and I didn't know a lot about until this past year. He was part of the first StarCast, and he was also in Vegas for StarCast 2. You know, we got to know each other a little bit, chatted a few times. But, I didn't realize that he was really with the WCW through it all. I mean, in those shitty days, and then, you know, the times of glory with the Monday Night Wars, and, of course, the mighty 83 weeks. And then he saw it all go to hell, and he was right there for every bit of it. And he started out by just hanging around, not even getting paid, really, and became very successful with them. He's an incredible story, so let's get to it. David Penzer, ding, ding, ding. Well, you know, folks, in the wrestling business, there is persistence, and then there is David Penzer, a man who took that will to succeed to the extreme, was there for the rise and fall of the WCW, and he has seen it all in the world of professional wrestling. Dave, thank you so much for coming on Primetime. How are you, my friend?
Thank you for having me. Great intro. Now I know why you're so successful in doing this. That was fantastic. Thank you.
Well, I mean, it's the damn truth. I've followed your career, then I've heard a few interviews that you've done, and my God, sir, I mean, I don't know if it's the you just wouldn't go away, or do we say it in the nice way to say the guy just wouldn't give up? I mean, whatever you call it, that's what it takes in this business, as we both know. But would you pretty much say that that was your journey?
I don't know if it wasn't going away or just kept showing up. I think a little bit of both. You know, I don't want to get ahead of the story, but there comes a time when I had to put my money where my mouth was, or the whole thing was going to fall apart. And thank God that I was able to, you know, to get past that hurdle and get the backup ring announcing job for WCW. But yeah, I mean, I started, you know, in Davie, Florida, hanging out at the Global Wrestling Alliance school. Yeah. And the only reason I got in the doors there was because the guy who ran it, one of the guys who ran it, he's an indie wrestler named Dr. Red Roberts, and he's also a shoot psychologist. Yeah. And my dad is a psychologist in that area, or was. He's retired now. But they had a friend in common, and the friend said, hey, this guy's a DJ and he's really interested in the wrestling business. Maybe he could ring announce for some shows. And they said, send him down to the school, let him talk to some people. And that's where I hung out. You know, I was recently on my podcast, had Alex Marvez on after Double or Nothing. And he's the same way. He got an invite because he was in the press part-time to go down to the school, and that's where me and Alex met. We were just two jabronis who loved the wrestling business, trying to figure out a way to get our feet in the door, and just hung out there. So it's pretty crazy. But yeah.
I was going to say, Dave, though, and I mean it as a great compliment of you know, just sticking with it. But you know, we've been doing this for a long time, and I just so many stories of these personalities that have made it in professional wrestling. And a big giant part of it is the fact that they just wouldn't give up. They wouldn't go away. They took every opportunity that came their way. And one thing I've discovered along the ride here is that you know, the podcast isn't just about wrestling. If you listen to these stories, they're really inspirational, because it may be the wrestling business, which I think is one of the toughest there, you know, that exists today and did back since it began to make it. And if you listen to these stories, you can get a lot out of them, because it's about people, when you come down to it, who a lot of them come from humble beginnings. They didn't have a lot to begin with. They got an opportunity. They have a great love for the wrestling business, but then they just, no matter what, we're going to somehow be a part of it. And you're certainly one of those stories. And before we get into you actually working in the business, and I believe that you were born in Atlanta. I don't know, did you grow up there as well? And what was your exposure? You mentioned your dad was a psychologist, but I imagine he must have been a wrestling fan too, somehow brought you into it, or at least got you interested. So how did that all start for you?
It's a pretty crazy story, and I don't mean to sound callous, but it is what it is. Actually, I was born in the Bronx and moved to South Florida when I was six. So I don't, yeah, you can't always trust the internet, as I've been burned a couple times on my deal. No, I only lived in Atlanta when I worked for WCW.
One of the research papers that I have on here that Casey sent me, my producer, that's like the first line on it. I'm like, are you sure about this? So yeah. Backing up, and it makes the story even richer here, is the fact that, you know, being born in the Bronx, now you got a chutzpah already being in that part of the country. So as we back up here, tell me a little bit more about that, because, you know, that certainly adds to the story here.
Well, I don't really remember that. I was six when I moved to South Florida, so I don't, you know, really remember being in New York. But yeah, hey, this is the first thing on my Wikipedia page, so I've been burned the hard way. You can't always trust the internet, and I don't know how to go in and change it, nor do I think anybody cares.
Well, I was born in Phoenix for a lot of people on that Wikipedia too, so yeah, that's not true.
Yeah.
I was born in New York as well.
So anyway, it was crazy what happened, man. And like I said, I don't want to sound callous, but it is what it is. We had cousins who were, the youngest boy was about my age. Mm-hmm. And crazy stuff happened. The father, who was a very famous dentist in South Miami, dropped dead of a heart attack. And a week later, the mother jumped off the top story of a building. And my parents were the next of, I forget what you call it. But so all of a sudden, I had two older sisters and an older brother that moved into our house. I was like 8 or 9.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, so it was pretty crazy. And it, of course, things like that don't end well. Yeah. But the point is my dad wasn't a wrestling fan, but this guy, Jeff, who was my cousin, who moved in and shared a room with me, one day turned on Channel 6 at 12 o'clock noon in WPIX, I think it was called. And there was championship wrestling from Florida and Ox Baker and superstar Billy Graham and Steve Strong. I have memories of it. I don't remember it verbatim, the first one I watched, but I can remember Steve Strong and superstar Billy Graham, Ox Baker, Joe LeDuc, Dusty Rhodes. And I was hooked. I was hooked. I watched every Saturday. You know, my dad did take me to the matches, although it was funny. We'd always joke about it. He would bring like three, like a Time magazine, a Newsweek, and a Psychology Today, and he'd sit there in the middle of the chaos, and he'd read all the magazines while I was, you know, cheering and booing and doing all the stuff. But first show I was at was Fort Lauderdale National Guard Armory in 1977, May. The main event was Ox Baker and Ernie Ladd, and I was hooked ever since then, and I watched everything and bought every wrestling magazine. And I've heard this story so many times from wrestlers, as you said. You know, once you get hooked, you know, you buy every wrestling magazine. There was no internet, obviously, but you know, then you discover the newsletter community years later, and start, you know, subscribing to every newsletter, and you know, really start to appreciate the, you know, not so much, you know, as a fan, but more of somebody who's interested in the, you know, a little behind the scenes, the ins and outs, how it all works, and, you know, start to learn a little bit about, you know, how it works. And then, you know, they say there's some people that, you know, oh, when they get smartened up, they get turned off as a fan. To me, when I got smartened up and made it, would open, it was like, it opened up, you know, a little door that I had been staring out of, and like, you know, and then, you know, all of a sudden there was a whole new horizon, not to sound silly, but there's a whole new horizon of stuff that I wanted to learn.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah, you know, it went beyond, you know, oh, who's the Florida champion, to, you know, how did this happen, and how did this happen, and how does the, you know, and a million questions that you, it's like a kid in a candy store.
Yeah, so it even became more intriguing for you at the time because of it became, I guess, in your view of it, you know, the whole new, you know, theater, dramas involved, the storylines, not only the fact that these guys have to be athletes, even though you could get away with a lot more back then. There wasn't the super muscle guys. There were some of them out there, but it was all about to change. But was that kind of what it did? I mean, it made it even more. It wasn't like being a fan of boxing or something.
Yeah, no. Once I found I got a little bit, you know, quote unquote smart, you know, wasn't totally smart till many years later. And you know, probably, you know, nobody's ever 1,000% smart, but, you know, cause there's still things I'm learning as we go, especially with the changing atmosphere and, you know, the wrestling business, the changing, face of what it's become and, you know, from what I grew up watching. But yeah, I just wanted to learn so much, and I was enamored by it. I was absolutely enamored by it. The angles, the interviews, how you could control people's emotions with simple, you know, with a simple hiding of a foreign object. That there wasn't even anything. It was somebody like pretending to hold something in their hand, and then pretending to put it under their arm, and then pretending to put it in their tights. Yeah. And you know, you could control 3,000-4,000 people in Miami Beach on a Wednesday night with nothing, just pantomiming. And to me, that's still what's, you know, I feel it in a tingle as I talk about it. That's still what gets me excited about this business. And, you know, the fact that you have that control over people if you know how to do it right. And, and then the storylines and all that. So, yeah. So, I decided once I got my pinky in the door, my toe in the door, I was going to do everything I could to try to get in, because back then, you know, it was totally different. I'm sure you know, but you know, today, you know, if my son is, my adult son is a wrestling fan. If he wanted to, he could go put up the ring for local indie shows, and you know, they probably wouldn't pay him, but they'd let him go in the dressing room, and he could probably ring the bell, and you know, it's pretty easy to get in. It's harder to stay in now. But back then they didn't creak the door open for just anybody. You had to have some kind of connection. Yeah. And even then you had to, you know, build the trust that, you know, that they could trust you with telling, you know, letting you in and bringing you on. So,
kayfabe, as they say. And,
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The whole part of that, maybe being a psychologist's son, intrigued you so much more. But you mentioned how the whole psychology of this, the storylines, you could do an arm bar for 5 minutes if you work in the crowd. Today, my God, you can barely get away with 30 seconds without something changing. I guess that's the best way to put it in the ring, where you. But back then, God, the whole psychology of it, the guys would go in there and, you know, just a headlock could last for 5 minutes, and the crowd would be just on the edge of their seats. It really has changed a lot.
Totally different game. I'm not saying one is better than the other.
No.
You know, because you got to evolve. Everything evolves, especially with technology the way it is these days. But yeah, like you said, I mean. You know, 20-minute match, and the finish would be nobody ever take a bump until the finish was a body slam or a head scissors or something like that, you know. And then, like you said, now you can't. Some in Japan, I think it works a little bit better from the little bit I see in Japan, but in the United States, the fans have no. I guess probably because, and I'm not trying to talk down about anybody, but because I have two boys, but I think attention spans are probably way lower because of everything. You got, you know, 24-hour news, cable news, and you got a camera right in your hand all the time. That's also a source of like an encyclopedia, a source of information, and so it's just totally different animal. I can't rate one versus the other. I look back fondly on my time as a fan and my time in the business when it was different. But I enjoy some of what I don't. I'm not one of these guys who say the business sucks. I hate the business. I like being surprised. So I always watch the Raw after WrestleMania. It's the only one I probably watch live and don't DVR. Because, you know, you never know who's going to walk out of the curtain, who's going to walk out behind the doors. And to me, that's always been the fun of the business.
Yeah. I do miss that aspect of it. I guess we call it old school of that storylines and psychology, but it is, it's a different business today. It's a lot more of the, visual and what the high spots they do in the ring, but that's I guess, another podcast, or at least later in this conversation. You mentioned being down in South Florida, right? That I spent most of the time you grew up in. What a rich area for wrestling that was. And a lot of people don't know, when they think of those days and earlier days, of course, you're around my age, but how those territories were kind of divided up. And when people thought of wrestling around the country, they would think, the East Coast, or of course the Mid South and those areas. But Florida had some great wrestling. It was a great territory.
Yeah. I didn't even appreciate it at the time. I was like 10 years old, as I said. And, when you're 10 years old and you turn on the show and you see it, you don't realize, I know it's hard for people to understand, but you don't realize that there's like all these other wrestling companies at the moment. This is wrestling. This is, and then as I got it to learn more about it and discovered magazines and stuff, I was like, oh my God, they got AWA and WWF and NWA and all these territories and all these places. And but when I first started watching wrestling, that was it. It was what I turned on Championship Wrestling from Florida. And it was some of the greatest talent looking back. I got the opportunity to see some of the legendary great heels and baby faces. Dusty Rhodes is a baby face, and Jack Briscoe, and the heels I remember even better. Joe LaDuke is one of my favorite, and Killer Carl Cox and Ox Baker, Ernie Ladd, and just so much great stuff. And then not to jump ahead, but then when we got to see Georgia Championship Wrestling, which became WCW years later, that was like discovering a treasure. I remember going to my friend's house because I didn't have cable television then, and on Saturdays at 6 and watching Georgia Championship Wrestling. And so you're seeing some of the same wrestlers, but a lot of the different wrestlers. And by then I had known of a lot of them through the magazines and stuff. And you get to see, they were putting on super shows. It looked like every other week at the Omni with all these stars flying in. So you got the Florida wrestling and the Georgia wrestling, and then the whole thing just, as because you were right there way before I was, the whole thing just blew up.
Yeah. No, really, it the world changed forever in the 80s, as we know. But it was an awesome time to be a wrestling fan and also to be a part of it. You mentioned your involvement of actually getting your toe in the door with the GWA down in Florida. And was it really just, I think you mentioned your dad knew somebody involved in the promotion, and they said, yeah, you can come down and hang out. Is that how it really started with you?
That was it, 100%, 1,000%. They were taping TV at the Diplomat Hotel, and they said, go ask for Dr. Ed Roberts. Larry Brannon was his name, real name. And so I asked for him, and he said, the guy's name was Alan, any friend of Alan's a friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And he said, we already have a ring announcer, and he didn't smarten me up. He said, don't go in the dressing room, but you can hang around here by the gorilla position. Well, he didn't call it the gorilla position at the time, where they go out, and, as long as you go in the locker rooms, you'll be cool. Right. And then after the night was over, he said, we have a school and office facility in Davie, Florida. Anytime you want to come by and just kind of hang out, pick our brains, let us know. And I probably thought, the kid never show up again. But I was there. I was there probably the next night.
Really?
And guys like Larry Malenko and Bob Roop took me under their wing. And, I say without those two, those two really I would sit there and listen to Larry Malenko, and he, for some reason, took a liking to me. I have no idea why. Maybe because they're both Jewish. I have no idea. But he took a liking to me, and he would tell me about the nuances of being a ring announcer and how to react and how to, and I wasn't even ring announcing yet. I hadn't done it one time, but he knew, obviously he looked at me and knew I wasn't going to be a wrestler. So and probably a referee wasn't going to work either. So I could talk in a microphone. So he, probably never thinking that anything would happen, he was just nice enough to sit there And, you know, for him, it might be killing time, but for me, it was a lesson it was lessons in, that I couldn't pay. If I had $1,000 an hour, I couldn't pay for those back in the day. So,
did you always want to be in front of a microphone? I don't know what you had aspirations as a kid to do that. Did you see somebody on TV that influenced you? I mean, was broadcasting something you were interested in? I think I heard you mention that you were a DJ or did something along those lines. But that was that something that in your mind that you thought, oh, if I was going to have a profession, this is what I'd like to do?
Well, it was more just about getting through my teen years. I got a job like most people as a busboy and waiting tables and you know, I hated it. So me and my best friend, we decided to start a mobile DJ company because it was sort of like when the mobile DJ craze was rising.
Oh, like
so
doing weddings and events and stuff like that?
Yeah. We just started doing like, you know, parties and Sweet 16s like for free.
Okay.
And then, you know, we started buying records and we improved our equipment. And a couple years later, you know, I was 16, 17 years old, was doing, like you said, weddings, bar mitzvahs, you know, making a few hundred dollars a gig. It's funny that the DJ business is so much easier now because all you need is a laptop and a couple of small speakers, but the money is still the same. These guys are making the same money. They don't have to carry on all the equipment and the records like I had to do, but there it's like the money has not gone up at all for a mobile DJ. It's ironic, but so it was a lot better than being a busboy and a waiter. And, you know, so, I did that on the weekends and so I got used to talking in front of a microphone and introducing the bridesmaids and the grooms and the cut the cake and all the different, you know, play the games with the kids at the bar mitzvahs. And I was just comfortable on a microphone. So I knew I had no athletic ability. I knew I was desperate to be involved in the wrestling business. I wasn't sure how, but I knew that my best chance was on a microphone because there wasn't going to be, you know, and I didn't think there was a good chance of that happening, quite frankly, but I knew that was the only way that it was going to happen.
But play by play, did you have bigger dreams than that? Or did you just, however I could do it, I would love to be a ring announcer.
I don't even know that I thought about play by play. I was always the host, you know, no matter what the party was you know, and at that time, Gordon Solie, you know, in my mind, Gordon Solie was championship wrestling from Florida, Georgia championship wrestling. He was everywhere. And he was even the ring in that, the play-by-play guy for Global Wrestling Alliance at the beginning.
Oh, wow.
So in my mind, you know, not knowing now, not knowing then what I know now, you know, I don't even know that play-by-play was an option. It was Gordon Solie. It was him. And there was nobody else.
He was the only guy.
Yeah. So to me, you know, hey, the only other opportunity with a microphone is a ring announcer. Boom. That's, you know, and I look back and we talk about it now. I haven't thought about it as much, but it's funny that you bring it up. How little of a chance I really had to make it work. I take it for granted because I think about now and you're saying you didn't think of play by play. You couldn't be a wrestler. You couldn't be a referee. And all you were talking about was a ring announcer. I don't know anybody else other than maybe Gary Capetta and I guess Howard Finkel, but, that started off as only a ring announcer. That was their only goal and made it a quote unquote career, so the chances, I guess, looking back were extremely slim, but I just, as long as there was a door open, I was going to push through it and I loved it. The thing is, it wasn't work for me. I ate it all up. So it was a passion.
Okay. So I'm going to take you back. When was the first, I guess, formal time, whatever it was, I don't know if it was at an armory or something, but when was the first official time that you stood in that ring with a microphone and was what you'd call a ring announcer?
So it was in Immokalee, Florida. It was Global Wrestling Alliance. Mm-hmm. And they for TV, they used an Elvis impersonator guy. So, but they were running house shows and I had finally earned their trust. And so they said, come to Immokalee. And me and my DJ partner at the time, who was also a big wrestling fan, drove out there. And I had no idea what to expect, Sean. I mean, I had not been officially smartened up. I knew, you know, some things, but I didn't know if the guys were really friends, if they, you know, you just don't know. It's not it, back then you didn't know what it was, you know. And so I got there, and I remember Adrian Street was there selling his book with the pink pages, and he was so proud of that. And, you know, I was just introducing myself to everybody. So I went into the locker room, and the first time I was ever in a wrestling locker room, and I had no idea what to expect, like I said. And the Iron Sheik, the main event was the Iron Sheik and Corporal Kirshner. Mm. And the Iron Sheik walked in, and he shook everybody's hand. How are you, sir? How are you, sir? How are you, sir? How are you, sir? And then, you know, so I'm just sitting there kind of taking it in. And then Corporal Kirshner walks in, and now I'm like, I'm thinking to myself, okay, now I'm going to see, are they friendly? Do they just get along? I know it all sounds so silly, but I'm taking you back on my journey. And all of a sudden, they saw each other, and they gave each other big bear hug. And I was like, the light bulb went off. It was like, you know, and I was like, okay, I finally got all the questions answered that I need answered. Now I need to focus on staying around. So, I did the show and did a couple other small shows, and the company went out of business, and me and Bob Roop, who had become a mentor by that time, bought the ring from the company after it went out of business and started doing indie shows, and spent the next couple of years driving up and down the road all the way as north as Fort Myers, Fort Pierce and Fort Myers, and all the way as south as Key West, promoting wrestling shows with Bob. And he was just, he just taught me everything he knew. We took a liking to me. We became family friends. He taught me everything he knew, and so many light bulbs went off in my head, you know, and things he would tell me that I had remembered watching as a kid or watching as a teenager that I didn't realize at the time exactly what was happening. Mm-hmm. And it was a whole new world, and he was nice enough to teach me that. He got a job working for Ole Anderson as an agent in WCW, and he said, yeah, I'll take care of you. And, you know, knowing what I know now about how you know, nobody wants to put their reputation on the line, especially for some mark who, you know, is a ring announcer. Yeah. The fact that he actually did go to bat for me and brought me and got me up there in any form or fashion, I owe so much to him. And then he introduced me to Jody Hamilton, the assassin, and who booked the enhancement talent for WCW. And Bob didn't last very long, because Ole didn't last very long, but Jody kind of took over where Bob was stepped in. And without those three guys, Larry Malenko, Bob Roop, and Jody Hamilton, this little 5'6" non-athletic Jewish guy would have never gotten to live his dream. So I am forever grateful.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yeah, and you mentioned here the different ways you can make a living in wrestling, and especially from an outsider, if you weren't one of the boys, if you weren't a wrestler. And you mentioned, you know, we call them enhancement talent. Back then, you know, they're known as jobbers. But I found it really interesting that that was a whole booking area as well, that you had to get people to come in and put these guys over. And that you made, they didn't pay you directly, but you made money by booking these guys.
Yeah, so I drove up to Gainesville, and Gainesville, Georgia was the first show I was ever at, and Bob had hooked me up, and And I met with Jody Hare. He said, bring five good talents and they'll each, and we'll pay for the rental van. We're not going to pay you. You pay for it. We'll reimburse you. We'll pay for the gas. And then we're not going to pay you, but the, each guy, tell each guy that they're going to pay you $25.
And that was kind of the way standard, that was standard then. That's what,
well, I didn't know that at the time. Yeah. But as I learned more, you know, instead of Jody booking, calling 25 individual guys and booking them every week or every other week, yeah. He had his own bookers. So he had Mike Jackson in Alabama, and he had George South and Italian Stallion in Georgia and the Carolinas, and he had Rip Rogers out of Kentucky, and I guess he needed somebody in Florida. So if each of those guys brought five or six guys, and he only had to deal with three, you know, four or five people, and then, you know, he got his 25 guys that he needed. Right. And, you know, so the guys were used to paying a booking fee. And I was terrified at first because I'm asking these wrestlers who I don't know all that well, you know, to give me a booking fee. And they were like, they didn't think twice. They're like, sure, you're providing the transportation, right? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. He's like, sure, no problem. So that's how it started.
Yeah, and so how did you find these guys? That, I mean, they couldn't be just these jabronis, you know, these guys that didn't know. They had to know somewhat what the hell they were doing. So how did you evaluate talent? I imagine after a while you got a stable of guys that you could use, but how did you even begin to get these people?
Well, when I first started, like I said, me and Bob Roop had done like 2 years of indie shows with all the local guys. So I kind of knew who, you know, I wasn't, you know, I didn't know that much about the business, but I knew who could entertain a crowd. Yeah, okay. And so, you know, I made sure to stick with those people. And, as I got more into it, I would take trips to Tampa, take trips to Orlando to see indie shows. And I had business cards made up, and I would, you know, I would find anybody who wanted to go. I remember, Mark Merrow was one of the guys that I booked up as an enhancement talent. Really? And, but he didn't want to drive up in the car, and he didn't want to give me the $25, but he said, if you book me, I'll meet you there and I'll give you, I think he said $15. I'm not sure, $10, whatever. Yeah. And at the time, you know, I was like, well, okay, that's an extra guy I don't have to put in my car. So it's found money. Yeah. And then Dusty fell in love with him, made him Little Richard, and the rest is history. Yeah. But that didn't happen to most of the guys. Most of the guys, they're just doing it to, you know, because if you were on TV, you know, you got a good payday. And if you were on TV nationally, you became a bigger star in your little area.
Right. You could, you know, somewhat
just being in the... Being in the ring with the Four Horsemen and Dusty Rhodes and Nikita Koloff and Magnum and all those guys, that just being in the ring with those guys, even if you didn't come out on top, and being able to hold your own a little bit for a couple of minutes, it made you, you know, look, once you're on television, you know, people have made careers in you know, they talk about viral moments. I remember recently you might have saw this, Sean. They had a little father and son and the son could hardly, he was like 1 year old, but they took video of them like having a conversation back and forth. I think it was about a basketball game. Did you see that?
No, it wouldn't.
Oh, it was, but they looked like they were having a conversation, an animated conversation back and forth, but the kid was 1 year old. He couldn't talk. So he was talking gibberish, and the father would say, yeah, I agree.
Oh, yeah,
I don't think
I saw
that.
Yeah, yeah. And the kid would just went on for a long time. And the kid and then he would talk, and the kid would,
my point is, they just signed to do a Denny's commercial. So being on television or the internet now, being in front of people's eyes is a powerful medium, and it gives you credibility. So those guys, they had credibility when they went back to Tampa or Orlando, and you know, they were the main events on those shows because they had just been on TV last week, and not only on TV, they were wrestling, you know, the big stars. So
back up a little bit, though. I want to explain to people, because I don't know if people realize how it went back in the day. I know the way it was with WWF and WWE, when you go to a town and we do TV tapings. But you mentioned how these guys would come in, and then you'd have your big stars, and you'd have enhancement talent, and that's what we would see on TV. And explain the reason why that's the way it was done, and then how people would see these guys at house shows.
Well, because they didn't want to give away the main, it was a totally different world, as we mentioned. Yeah. They didn't want to give away the main events on television.
Yeah.
It wasn't about ratings back then. It was about having good houses.
Yeah,
and, there was no pay-per-view. There was nobody really got paid for television back then at the time. You were lucky if you didn't have to pay for it, actually, if you could just do a barter deal. And so it wasn't about, good television ratings. It was about getting eyes on your product, so then build up the big matches. So they didn't put on TV Dusty, Nikita, and the Road Warriors against the Four Horsemen. They wanted you to pay your money to go see that in Hampton, Virginia, or the Omni in Atlanta, or every city they ran in. And so they put the Road Warriors and Dusty and Nikita against, and no disrespect to these guys, but Bob Cook and Rick Ryder and Ripper Rogers and, Joe Kazana. I'm just thinking of names of guys that worked back then. And good workers who would have a competitive match with those guys. But at the end, the guys get their hand raised and then cut an interview about what they're going to do when they get their real nemesis at the arena near you.
Yeah. And that's the way it worked back then, folks, that's how wrestlers made their living. And that's how the superstars were paid. Even in the WWF, they got paid from house show money. And that's what the entire Superstars and Wrestling Challenge was all about, promotion. That's what the Event Center was. I would be on, three times during that show. And we were basically just saying, hey, go to the house show. And that's how the superstars made their livings. They would get a percentage of the gate, whatever that might be. But that's how it was done. So enhancement talent was a big part of it, especially the good ones. And you mentioned a few of the guys, and no disrespect at all. I did an interview with Barry Horowitz. And these guys...
Great guy.
And as I said, there was a difference to me. And even back then, and we didn't call them enhancement talent, Dave, but to me there was the jobbers, and those are the guys that they would bring in that were basically hamburger for the superstars to go out and destroy. And then you had...
They wrestled the Road Warriors.
Yes, exactly. They would just destroy them. And then you had the Steve Lombardis, you had the Barry Horowitz, the Mike Sharps would come on that you would put with an established star, and this guy could actually work, and then made them look even better. It wasn't where, like you said, you get the Road Warriors out there or whatever who would just basically just beat the living crap out of these guys and just look mean and nasty. That's all they had to do. The other ones, though, there was a whole different level of talent.
One thing about that era and that whole process that goes unremembered a lot is because you represent yourself, Event Center. When I was in WCW and finally was on the road full time with them, I was producing the market specific interviews, which is basically your Event Centers.
Yeah.
And we had we were very lucky to have, God bless him, Gene for a while, and then we had Lee Marshall, and then I actually did it towards the very end. And they set up a gray box with air conditioning in the parking lot behind the truck, and we would do them out of the gray box. And what the point I'm getting to is that's where some of the young guys would get a chance to hone their interview craft.
Right.
Because they didn't get a lot of interview time on the main TV. So I remember guys like Chavo Jr., and Chris Jericho. Chris will be the first one to tell you he was the first one at that gray box every week. And because you weren't always going to get Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair in that gray box. You tried, and if it was a big enough arena, they would make sure to get them there for you. But when you were going to, Sunrise, Florida, or Augusta, Georgia, or Muncie, Indiana, you had to get creative. And the guys like Chris Jericho, there's so many guys that I can remember that just lived in that gray box and honed their craft by cutting. That's how they learned how to cut promos. And that's, as we know, a lost art as well. So that's the part of that whole enhancement, building to the arenas and all that. I think that's the part that suffers the most is the fact that these guys don't get that interview time that they did to hone their craft and learn their character.
Yeah, that's a great point, Dave, because I remember back when I worked there and just how you'd see these guys come in who they could barely put a sentence together, and then just doing it, with the Event Center interviews, and these guys would do, 20, 30 at a time, and they and see them get better and better. And I mean, like a big example, just off the top of my head, is Bret Hart. Bret was
sure.
It's not that he hadn't been in front of a microphone before that, but when you saw how in that couple of years there, the couple 3 years there, that he became very good at doing it. There was so many others too, and you're right. You don't get that opportunity. And you mentioned Jericho. Now he saw the opportunity there. And knew that that was his way to improve. You got to get out there and do it. And you had other guys that just didn't take advantage of it and thought that their ring skill was going to help them succeed. And you have to have it all. And that's really a great point, because cutting a promo is an art. There's no question about it.
You could tell which young guys were hungry,
yeah,
and which ones were serious about having a future in the business as opposed to collecting a paycheck,
yeah,
by who was hanging around that gray box just waiting for the opportunity. And not only was it an opportunity to learn their interview style, it was an opportunity to work with Gene Okerlund, who I miss him so much.
Oh,
and
I
know you got to work with him too, and I'm sure you miss him just as much. He could do an interview, with a hockey stick and make it entertaining.
Yeah.
So if the guy couldn't talk, talking with Mean Gene could carry anybody. So, that made him at ease, because they're working with a guy that, even if they mess up or even if they get lost, Gene has their back, and Gene's the best ever. To be able to learn the process of cutting your promo and learning your character, but doing it with a guy like Mean Gene Okerlund, who is the best of all time, in my opinion. Talking about me getting Larry Malenko and how much knowledge and value if you look back, you couldn't pay for that kind of value. Guys like Jericho and Eddie and Chavo and people like that, who got to hone their craft under being Gene Okerlund, as far as interviews go, that's invaluable. There's not enough money that you could pay to get that kind of education.
Do any come to mind? You mentioned how you saw some of these guys progress, and Jericho certainly being one of them. Do you remember any others that were just really rough when they started, and you saw them develop over a period of time and become very successful?
Chavo was one. He kind of got thrown to the fire because his last name was Guerrero, and Eddie was hot, and he really had not gotten a lot of experience, as opposed to Eddie, who had wrestled in Japan, Mexico, ECW, and all of that crop of guys. Dean Malenko, they had experience in Japan. I think Chavo went over to Japan one time, and all of a sudden they threw him on TV with Steven Regal, who can make anybody look a million bucks.
Yeah.
And of course, if your last name is Guerrero, he's going to make him look like a million bucks, and got a contract. And I remember I would ride with him and Jericho and Eddie and Chris Benoit, which is a whole different story. But, and Chavo was, I had him on my podcast a couple months ago, and he told me, that he had a whole, they say it takes a village. He had a whole village, Eddie and Dean and Chris and Perry Saturn and Kurt Hennig. And, all these guys that would, had his back, because they kind of threw him to the fire and trial by fire. So he was one that stands out. The first time I ever saw Rey Mysterio, I knew there was something special with that guy. I didn't know if he'd be world champion, because it was a different era in which he became. But the first time I saw Rey Mysterio wrestle, there was something special with the kid. And to this day, he's I think one of the most talented in-ring performers. And really, you talk about the high acrobatic style that we see now, really was the innovator of that style.
Yeah.
Made it seem almost easy.
He just took it to a whole different level. I mean, we'd seen some high flyers before, but not like what Ray was doing.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when they promoted that he was going to be there, and people were how guys talk in the locker rooms, and they're like, yeah, I heard this guy's like 5'5", and you know, like 120 pounds, and I wonder how it's going to work. So, you know, he didn't even realize it, but he had a lot of pressure walking in that dressing room and walking up to that ring on Nitro because of his size. At the time, when you were that size, you were not taken seriously as an athlete, as a pro wrestler. And he was just so good from the first thing from the first move he did, he was so good that you just didn't even realize he was 5'5" and 140 pounds or whatever he was. Yeah. He was just the special attraction that did things that nobody else could do and make them look so smooth that everybody should be able to do them. And it was amazing. And yeah, it's funny. I'd love to get Ray on the podcast. You know, contractually, I don't think he's allowed to do it on mine. But I don't even think he realized how much pressure he had. I wonder if he even knows how much pressure he had with the boys kind of talking behind his back when they first heard about him coming in. And I say that with no disrespect, but it was just a different era. And, you know, exactly. It was a big guy's, especially then it was a big guy's business.
Well, that's exactly the point there is that, you know, you didn't put a little guy up against a big monster. And because it just was, you know, unreal if you tried to put him over at all. But the thing with Ray, though, is that he made those matches believable, that he could go up against somebody like that. And the way that he moved and the different, you know, attacks that he had on some of these, you know, where he could go up somebody against like Batista. And you bought that. Yeah, I believe it because he was so, you know, so he could trick these guys. He had these moves that would come around swinging off the ropes and, you know, flipping off the top rope and grabbing their up the turnbuckle and, you know, twisting, doing a leg scissor on their head. And I mean, just all of the different things he did, you bought it. I mean, it was believable, but you're right. I could imagine him coming in, which I didn't see when he came in, how much pressure he must have faced and also getting guys to agree to go into the ring with him.
Well, at first he started with the luchadors who knew him from Mexico. And then he was able to step to the next level. But you got to remember, and you know this too, because you were there in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, it was all about bodies. Okay. You know, there were guys like, and nothing, I take nothing away from any of these guys, but guys like Van Hammer and Todd Champion, who didn't have a lot of training, but they were put out there because they had a good look with a muscular body. So, you know, all of a sudden this little guy comes in and people start wondering, you know, well, you know, this is a big man's business now. so it would be interesting to find out if he knew how much pressure that he had from the locker room. But he didn't take long for that pressure to go right away. Because as soon as he started, like, you know, like I said, 2 minutes in, you knew you were seeing something special.
Yeah. And he was one of the people who opened a lot of doors for smaller guys and made it a big part of what we have seen since. We got off track there a little bit, but, you know, you saw the WCW. You mentioned, you know, how you got in, but you really saw the rise and fall of the WCW. And, you know, where did it go from being, I guess, an agent to the enhancement talent to where you really started doing a lot of different jobs, I guess, within that organization?
Well, when I first started going up, I said, you know, is there anything that I could do to help out? I'm there. I'm not, you know, and so ironically, one of the things I would do is run and get guys for the market specific interviews. We didn't have a gray box back then. They did it in another part of the arena with a green screen. Right. And, so I would do that for Jim Ross, and then they started to trust me a little bit more. I'd sign in the guys because everybody had to sign in their real name and their signature. It was sort of like it probably wasn't worth the paper it was written on, but it was sort of a release that they could put you on television and if you got hurt, you know. And then the enhancement guys, whenever the new enhancement guys came in, they needed, you know, their social security number and tax info and all that. And before you know, it's funny, Tommy Rich and Junkyard Dog gave me the name Walking Man. Because all I do the whole day and night is walk around getting signatures, getting papers filled out, eventually running off the formats when they were ready. And so
if you had a Fitbit, you probably would have walked how many miles? 10?
God, a lot more than I do now. Yeah, probably 10 miles. But yeah, they call me walking man. Look at that walking man. He's always walking.
Did you have a position? I mean, did they pay you a regular job, or how did it work?
No.
Per diem?
I was a stooge.
You just hung out.
I was there anyway, and I was willing to work, and they didn't have to pay me, and I was hungry, and wow. I would do anything they asked me to do, or even stuff that nobody else wanted to do, like filling out paperwork and stuff like that, you know. So I just, like I said, I 100 miles an hour, I was going to keep going until somebody said you can't go anymore.
See, and I mentioned, like I said at the top, man, you're the, you know, you there's the persistence, and then there's David Penzer. Really? That's
it's kind of true.
Yeah, so you weren't even getting paid. You just did it because for the love of it, and you wanted to get in.
Yeah. Oh, I wasn't getting paid a dime. I did first time I ever got paid was when I did the backup ring announcer gig. It was funny because Jim Ross was the announcer, and he was in charge of the announcers and the ring announcer. And then, if you remember, there was a time that Jim Ross went to WWF and Tony Schiavone came back to WCW. Well, I had told Jim Ross a couple of times, we talked about it, hey, you know, I'm a ring announcer down in Florida. If you ever need, you know, I work hard, you know, from walking around and helping you get guys and stuff. If you ever have an opportunity for need a ring announcer, you know, give me a shot. So, but then Tony came up to me like the second week he was there, and he's like, you the guy who drives the guys from Florida, right? I was like, yeah. He's like, well, we need a backup ring announcer, and there's a guy who used to work for WWF. You probably remember him, Sean. His name is Dino Puglia.
Okay.
And he said, will you drive him up? And I'm thinking to myself, all right, it's now or never. You got to speak up, Penzer. Yeah. I was intimidated as heck. But I said, you know, I had told Jim Ross before he left, and I don't think I ever got a chance to tell you, but I ring announced too on the indie shows. I'd love an opportunity. You know, I've been working hard here trying to get my foot in the door. He said, I'll tell you what, next week you can bring up Dino, and then the week after that, you'll get a shot. And whoever's the best ring announcer will hire you. And quite frankly, I think I won by default. I was coming up there anyway. I was driving up there anyway, so they didn't have to buy me a plane ticket. They didn't have to put me in a, you know, I was already coming up there, and I was already doing a whole bunch of things. And, you know, Dino didn't blow anybody away. He had a great voice, but I think he missed a couple of intros, and, you know, he introed the wrong guy first, and I was petrified. And I told you early on, this was my moment now. Think about this, all the blood, sweat, and tears that I had put in, and this was my moment. I said I could ring announce, and I said I could be a ring announcer, and I could be part of this company. And if it wasn't going to work, there was no use in coming up anymore.
Right.
I mean, there just wasn't. If they said no, then, you know, the dream was over.
Wow.
And so that's a lot of pressure. And I wrote out every single word I was going to say on a piece of paper in the ring, not only just like the introductions, but every single word I was going to do in the warm-ups, and every single word I was going to, things I would say between matches, and how to rile up the crowd, which I learned from Gary Capetta, who was a master at it.
Yeah.
And like I said, I think I won by default. I don't think I was great at first, but I was coming up anyway. So let the guy come up and bring your tuxedo, and you do the syndicated shows.
Well, either way, like you said, probably all that footwork, and literally was footwork that you did. To get there, it paid off. And so you became...
Yeah, I mean, just even being there to listen to Gary, you know, while you rang the bell sometimes during the match, during TV, and, you know, where I was backstage, and just being able to listen to Gary to, you know, because it was different. I know WWF, WWE, they don't really have the announcers talk in between, the ring announcer talk in between the matches. But in WCW, probably because we didn't have a Hulk Hogan, so to speak, that we could put on at the end of the night,
mm-hmm.
and that would keep the crowd there. We had to sell them disdain.
Yeah.
So it was always a sell job. Between every match was a sell job. You know, tell them who's coming up. You know, tell them they're going to be on TV. You know, tell them to yell and scream. And so, you know, that it was a totally different entity.
Wow.
It's funny when the last Nitro. Again, we're jumping ahead. I have a habit of doing that, unfortunately. The last Nitro, as you know, Shane McMahon was there because he was doing the angle. And Shane stopped me after the Nitro was over and said, I've never seen a ring announcer do anything like that. You do a great job out there getting the crowd into it. And I was very humbled, and I said, thank you, sir. I really appreciate that. And I thought maybe that it might help me get a gig. But but then I thought about it, and yeah, the announcer, they don't talk between matches.
No,
so
no.
Obviously he had never seen that.
Yeah. Well, that is really interesting, yeah, that you're a part of the show. In a lot of cases, especially in the latter years with the WWF, is, you know, the less the ring announcer is seen and heard, that's pretty much it. They do it as a kind of a formality. But back then, you know, Howard had his own style, but he wasn't doing anything in between matches like that. You were definitely part of the show. And when did it become a regular gig that you were, you know, the guy?
Well, just the main guy, it didn't happen until 1994. Gary Capetta had told me he was leaving when his contract was up. Yeah. I didn't believe him for 30 seconds, and I certainly didn't believe that they were going to put my green you-know-what out there in his place.
But you were working the whole time there. I mean, full-time job doing the other jobs that you had and filling in at house shows? Is that how it worked?
It became pretty much a full-time job for about a year before Gary left. Because I went on the road because Gary, obviously the pay that I was getting per night versus what Gary was getting was a lot different, and the house shows weren't drawing very well. So unless Hulk Hogan or Ric Flair, well, Rick was on almost all the shows, but unless Hulk Hogan, who they had brought in, was on the show, I was doing most of the house shows. So again, a way to hone your craft and learn and yeah, make a little money. I wasn't getting rich, but I was slowly but surely eking out a living, doing what I love to do. And like I said, Gary came to me and said, I'm gone in 6 months. And then said 3 months later, I'm gone. And he tried to teach me some stuff. And sure enough, I think it was it the Dayton, the Hera Arena in Dayton, which I saw recently got badly damaged by a storm that went through there, but it's one of my favorite buildings to play. Mm-hmm. It was Spring Stampede. It was in April. It might not have been Spring Stampede. The main event was Flair against Randy Savage. Oh, wow. And I was sure up until the time I went out that they were going to have somebody come in and do the ring announcing, because I had never been on pay-per-view before. I'd never been on the A show before. I was always just on the house shows and the B syndicated shows. Yeah. And Eric Bischoff came in and said, it's your job. Go run with it.
Wow.
And I said, yes, sir. I'll do my best. And you know, at that point, they moved me to Atlanta and put me on a salary, which was not very much at all, but it was, you know, for somebody who had a young kid and one on the way, it was something. Yeah. And, you know, got to work, you know, got all the benefits of Turner Broadcasting, so insurance and 401k and all that stuff. But I was in. I was just living my dream. And then who'd ever thought that we'd explode the way we did with Monday Night Show? And
It's amazing that, you know, you saw the WCW evolve. And at what point do you remember it really starting to change? Did it happen before Eric took over? When did you start to see things really start to happen where you started to see this wave building?
When Scott Hall walked down the steps in Macon, Georgia, and cut his promo about Steam Gene, where you want a war, we're here to give you a war.
Yeah.
That's when I said, holy crap. This is on, and this is good.
Yeah.
And that's sort of when it took off. This NWO started, Hulk turned heel, and away we went. And all of a sudden, we went from, you know, doing little 3,000-seat arenas to, at one point, we were selling out stadiums all over the place. It was crazy. It's absolutely nuts. You know, when the NWO got hot, you know, we used to go to some of these towns we would go to and get 500, 600, 700 people on a regular basis. And all of a sudden we'd show up, like Greenville, South Carolina. We showed up one day and was sold out, 3,500 people. And we was like, sold out? What is sold out? We didn't know sold out. There was no such thing as sold out.
Yeah.
It was, if you could hit 1,000 people, it's a good house. And all of a sudden it sold out, Biloxi, Mississippi. I'll never remember. It was Sting and Randy Savage against Hall and Nash as the Outsiders. And we used to put, you know, 600, 700 people in that place. And all of a sudden it had 6,000 people in there. Wow. And it was just all of it. It's hard to explain, Sean. It just started happening and the momentum ran, and we went on a roll that nobody could have ever predicted. I'm pretty sure Eric would tell you the same thing. And I just rolled with it. Off we went.
You know, and you, you talk about that, you know, Scott Hall stands out to you, NWO, when that formed. And it wasn't like the WCW didn't have some really great talent there. And during those years, the time that, you know, I was with the WWF, they had really great talent. A lot of them ended up coming to the WWE. But, and they mentioned a lot of people, they say, you know, Eric had this one great idea and it built all the franchise there. Do you think it was NWO? That's what really started this. And then, you know, they, of course they got more talent, but was that kind of the focal point?
Well, I mean, I think it started when we did the first Nitro and they brought out Lex Luger, who was supposed to be in WWE, and he actually was on a taped show. Yeah. He had been in Western Canada the night before on a house show teaming with Davey Boy Smith, and that was the first time they ever really kayfabed the boys, everybody. Nobody knew, like three people knew that Lex Luger was there. And so I could remember seeing Lex Luger walk out, and I sort of thought, game on. All right, they're here. They're not messing around. We may not have a good shot, but they're at least giving it the college try. Yeah. And the ratings came back, and everybody was shocked. And so the next week we went to Miami, and we did it again. And that was head-to-head, and I think the ratings stayed about even. And you know, you were there. WWF at the time was mostly character driven. You know, everybody had a gimmick, you know, the garbage man, the hockey player, the coal miner and all the different stuff. And I think it was just a different fresh product, and people found it quickly. Eric was brash and bold about giving away what was going on in the tape shows. And that was sort of different. So I just think the word started getting around and people started watching it. And then the perfect storm developed because WWF responded with the Scheme Gene and the Billionaire Ted skit.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, Paul and Nash are available to pretty much walk from one place to the other with very little weight. And then to incorporate both those things, to have those guys come in under the guise of, we're, you know, you want a war, we're here to battle you. We're really from the outside. We're from WWF, and we're here to invade WCW. That was something that had really never been done before in the U.S. on any major level. And the execution, I thought, was brilliant. And then when Hulk turned heel in Daytona Beach, that was, you know, like I said, we were off and running and I was just along for the ride. I'd go wherever they took me.
You know, in a lot of ways, the WWE unwittingly helped the war become what it was. If Vince had stuck to what he always you know, said he stood by, they wouldn't have noticed. The other group didn't exist. The fact that when they did recognize that this competition existed, as you said, game on, but it helped both organizations. And for that period of time, 83 weeks, no. But what a great time for professional wrestling. If you're a wrestling fan, my God, it could not have gotten better.
Yeah, like I said, it was a perfect storm, and you would just wait to see who was coming out, and we didn't know. You know, there was almost every week somebody new was coming out. You know, they were trotting Virgil out and Ted DiBiase out, and you know, X-Pac, and you just never knew who was going to walk out in the black and white and join the NWO, and it became must-watch television for sure.
Yeah.
You know, it was must-watch for us because we had no clue. You know, the last segment of every show in the format was TBD.
And
only Keith Mitchell, the producer. Well, we had the match, and then under the match notes, it was TBD. And Keith Mitchell knew, he was the executive producer in the truck, and the director knew, obviously, and you know, Jane Engel knew because she was in charge of hiding them. But other than probably Hulk knew, I'm sure, and Hall and Nash. But other than that, you know, Piper would come out, Ultimate Warrior would come out. Nobody had a clue. I had no clue. When I heard the bagpipes, I popped as much as anybody else did because I was a huge Roddy Piper fan. I had no clue. I popped as much as sitting ringside with a microphone in my hand inside. Obviously, I couldn't, you know, yell and scream in the microphone, but yeah. I popped as much as the people sitting at home did. It was amazing.
Well, you said you'd like to be surprised. I missed this.
That's what I said. I missed the surprises. That's why I like, I really love a good being fooled because, you know, it's great that the fans now could see the inner action of the, you know, inner parts of the business. And I guess that's cool. I guess it's a whole different wave, but I miss being surprised. I miss that little mark in me, that little 10-year-old boy in me that turned on Channel 6 and saw superstar Billy Graham, Steve Strong, and Ox Baker. And got excited. I missed that. And that was one of the cool things about Nitro is you never knew who was going to walk out that door, so you had to watch live.
Yeah. And I think that we talk about that period, and it really was a great time for professional wrestling. It was never going to be the same again. Vince McMahon might not agree, but boy, did it change the industry as far as what they were doing down at WCW, actually paying guys a lot of money and giving them contracts. Which are guaranteed money, but it was great to see that happen. I think if we look back and, and it's changing again, which is another conversation, but at that point in time, man, did it rock the industry and the business side of this and in favor of the boys and women, I should mention as well, but it just really was just something that needed to happen and what a great period of time.
Yeah. And then, also, and there came a time that WCW sort of ran out of surprises and sort of didn't know how to finish off the whole NWO story. Yeah. So it kind of dragged on. And that's when WWE came up with the Attitude Era with Steve Austin and The Rock. And you never knew what they were, Vince McMahon as a character, a heel character. And then that became must watch TV. And we weren't must watch TV anymore because everybody wanted to hear what The Rock was going to say, what Stoke Home was going to say, what he was going to do in his, in his escapades against Mr. McMahon, bring a beer truck out and, scorch them all in beer in the middle of the ring or whatever. It switched, and it almost switched on a dime.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the storyline of this that people don't know about is what happened behind the scenes. Now, there are books out there, but you were right there. And was it always a circus backstage, and did it just change be when, when you're riding this big wave and everybody's having a great time and everybody's making a fortune? It's a lot different than when the business starts to go down. Guys have these guaranteed contracts. Their egos are just as big as they always were. Was it always a circus?
No, but people got, like you said, the egos got big. There's a lot of huge money involved,
right.
And I didn't see much of that. But there was a lot on the upper, and even some towards the end on the lower level if you're a wrestler. But yeah, you could sort of see it, slowly but surely, the formats would change more often later in the day. And then it got to be that sometimes the formats, we didn't even have a format when we went live. Keith Mitchell would tell me in my IFB what to announce, and the announcers had no idea. They were just talk about calling what they see. They're literally calling what they were seeing without any guide. And then it sort of went off the track, and they tried to put it back on the track a bunch of times. I give them credit. And, you never know if Eric would have been able to buy the company and keep the time slot, the TV, mm-hmm. They might've been able to make it work. But, once the writing was on the wall, a lot of it, I've come to figure out, Sean, that a lot of it had to do with not so much us falling apart and losing a ton of money, but that even if we were doing really well, that once Time Warner and AOL merged with Turner and Turner lost power, they were going to find a way to make us go away. And we just kind of helped them in their goal, but that was going to be the goal at the end of the day anyway. We just sort of maybe sped it up a little bit because we were pretty dysfunctional, but it wasn't always that way. No, it was, it went from like a, you know, a football team working together to try to be it from an underdog to a Super Bowl champion to a bunch of guys with big contracts and big egos. And look, you know, I'm sure those guys look back and say, hey, you know, I got caught up in it, and it's easy to get caught up in it. But, you know, that's just what it was. And it was difficult. You know, I'm not going to lie and say it wasn't difficult. Thank God the mind has a way to erase a lot of the negative and only remember the positive. So all these years, 20 years later or so, you know, I don't remember a lot of the negative. I remember a lot of the positive stuff. But yeah, there was a lot of negative. It was pretty crazy towards the end.
Yeah. And it's like anything else. It can't last forever. It was a unique time that, as you say, talk about NWO and how great that was. What they did with it, and having and Hulk involved, and that was, you know, I remember when he came in there, people were questioning, "Oh boy, you know, how's this going to work?" Well, man, that's in a lot of ways why it worked, and these other personalities. But at some point, it has to end. And of course, it was helped along, as you mentioned, you know, the change of management, so to speak, with Time Warner and AOL, and as you mentioned. But they started putting restrictions on what could be done on television, on their television. And then Vince was in a situation where they were desperate, and they took it from, it was no longer family entertainment in a sense. It became, in many ways, adult entertainment, and that helped them get to where they did. And at some point, you know, that machine was just going to outlast what was going on down south. But it was really just a really, really incredible period of time for professional wrestling that changed the industry forever. And I don't think it could have been sustained, but really it's just such a great period of time. And really, in the end, it was very beneficial for the business.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, yeah, especially for the guys. The guys, like you said, they went from working totally off the houses to having guaranteed money and merch, part of the merchandise, which was something that really wasn't a big deal back in the 70s and early 80s. And video games, you know, I heard WWE were getting huge, you know, almost six-figure video game checks every 6 months. So, I mean, that was stuff that nobody ever expected. And a lot of people that saved their money that were around back in the day, a lot of people that saved their money are pretty well off right now. And you know, a lot of people that are working now with WWE, because it's a public company and because of the structure of guaranteed money, you know, they may not be stars on television, all of them, but from what I hear, they're all making a pretty darn good living.
Yeah. And for you, Dave, as you look back, what was really the beginning of the end, when it was you knew it was going to be over? And then what was the final act for you?
I don't know that I ever thought it was going to be over. I thought that Eric was going to buy the company, and I thought that I was working very tightly with John Laurinaitis. If the company would have been bought by Eric, and we would have kept the television time, the plan was that John Laurinaitis was going to be Eric's right-hand man, and I was going to be, I already was, John Laurinaitis' right-hand man. I got involved in talent relations and stuff like that, and John took a liking to me, kind of took me under his wing, and I would do a lot of data, a lot of comparisons to keeping track of what angle, when the ratings went up, when the ratings went down from week to week, and what were the players involved. And they were really starting to get serious and trying to, you know, pay attention and not do everything on the fly. And so from what little I knew about what Eric was going to do if he bought the company, I really thought that they had a decent chance to make it. Maybe not on the level that it was before, but I didn't think it was going away. Yeah. I didn't realize at the time, because of my position, like I said, and I've come to realize now through books and talking to Eric and talking to Craig Leathers and Keith Mitchell, that, you know, they knew it was doomed, because they knew that you know, AOL and Time Warner didn't want a wrestling company and they're going to make it go away. I didn't know that at the time, probably better off, because it would have driven me nuts to know that I'm on a sinking ship, because at least, you know, there was always a light at the end of the tunnel in my eyes. But, yeah, so I woke up one morning and I turned on the internet. I had a friend call me, and I turned on the internet and I turned on the splash page to WCW.com, and I'll never forget it. And the upper left-hand corner, it had the WWF logo. Nice. And then then right in the middle of the screen, it had purchases. And then on the bottom right, it had the WCW logo. That's how I found out.
Wow.
And what a deal. I looked at my wife and I said, what are we going to do now? And so I went out to that last night show and I said, look, whatever it happens, I'm going to leave it all out there. And I worked my butt off and worked hard and the great thing was, thank God, knock on wood, I had 8 months severance pay. So I didn't have to figure out what I was going to do like the next week, yeah. You know, so I had full pay and full benefits for 8 months. So it gave me a chance to figure out what I was going to do, and ended up working for a upstart company called the XWF out of Tampa, yeah. Yeah. That never got off the ground. And then I had to kind of find my way without the wrestling business for a while until I started doing some stuff with TNA, ring announcing for them. And you know, now I'm a realtor and I've owned a couple of side businesses, and you know, you got to figure out life after wrestling. But at least between the severance pay and the XWF, it gave me a little bit of time to figure out life after wrestling.
Yeah, and you think about that deal, man. What a deal Vince got. Just the library alone was just, what a steal for.
I remember Hulk saying, "If I knew, I'd offered him double."
Yeah, God, it's just amazing because you look at what's on the. He pretty much owns it all now. I mean, there's just not a whole lot out there that they don't have. But really, it's just amazing how it all ended. And you mentioned the XWF. Was that just a bunch of guys saying, okay, now what do we do? Is that how that formed with all those guys?
Sort of. But, I mean, there was money behind it. But it was sort of... the Nasty Boys and Jimmy Hart and Greg Valentine, of all people. Randy Savage really started the ball rolling, but then walked away towards the end of the deal and didn't want to be involved anymore. I'm not sure why. But it started out with Randy Savage and Jimmy Hart trying to find another viable option for professional wrestling. Mm-hmm. Sort of what TNA was trying to do, but totally different way. TNA tried to weekly pay-per-views. We were trying to do just the same old weekly television show. And we had Piper and Sable and the Road Warriors and a lot of big names, Steiner Brothers. And they got some money backers through a guy named Kevin Harrington, who's out of Tampa. If you might remember, he originally was a shark on Shark Tank,
and then got
replaced by Mark Cuban. And he had invented one of the inventors of the infomercial, and he found some money people to buy the company to fund the company, and we put together 5 hours of episodic television and, had some big names. Mean Gene was there and Bobby Heenan, Tony Schiavone and Jerry Lawler were the announce team. Well, you could see the problem start when Jerry Lawler showed up and he had been desperately trying to get back in WWF for months because he had been let go. I guess something happened with him, Stacy Carter at the time. Uh-huh. And it was pretty well known, so I'm not saying anything that anybody didn't know about.
He's told
you know?
The story too. So
yeah. And he came in and said, "Well, I got to deal with Vince." And then Hulk Hogan was involved in our tapings, and Hulk Hogan shortly had to deal with Vince, and then they brought Mean Gene back and Bobby Heenan back and Kurt Hennig back, and all of a sudden we're out showing a tape with a bunch of talent that are well known, but we don't have
anymore
because they didn't put these guys under contract. You can't afford to put all these guys under contract. Yeah. We just figured, hey, you know, these guys are going to stick with us because there's nothing else, mm-hmm. and other than WWE. But once Vince got, I don't know if it was Vince or somebody in WWE, but once he got a whiff that there was some heavy names
something
that were trying to go against him, he grabbed a bunch of the main players, and that was the end of that, as they say.
Dave, really, I appreciate you taking the time. I don't know if you get a chance. I mean, you get interviewed here once in a while on podcasts, and I know you have your very own podcast, Sitting Ringside with David Penzer. But do you ever take the time to think about, man, I did all that? I was around all these people. You were a kid who just wanted to, hang out and just be a part of it.
Yeah, and it's amazing because I tell people, you know, I live my dream. Now the rest is gravy. So I had to figure out what to do after I live my dream. And you know, I figured it out. And thanks to the WWE Network and a little nostalgia becoming big in the wrestling business, you know, somebody like me could have a podcast where people actually like to listen. And you know, who would have known that? It's you know, I still have to pinch myself sometimes, Sean. You know, I wake up and I have to sell houses, and if I don't have any clients, I don't have any business. And so, you know, it's, and then, you know, my mom calls me and says, you'll never guess what happened. And I said, what happened? She said, I called to make some rental car reservations for a trip that we're going on. And they asked me what my last name was. And I said, Penzer. And the person on the other line said, P-E-N-Z-E-R, like the ring announcer.
Yeah.
And yeah. You know, that just happened this past weekend. And I said, yeah, if only that was the, you know, that's an anomaly. It's not the norm, but you know, just to have that little 10 seconds of fame and to be able to live my life. And not only that, as you said, be part of an era of professional wrestling that may not ever be, redone. Probably never will be redone. Yeah. You know, there's a little rumblings now, as we all know, but you know, we don't know how that's all going to work out. It's an absolute honor. I got to be friends with my heroes, and you know, I can't overstate it enough how much of an honor it is to have been a part of the business that I love, to have gotten to know the guys that I used to look up to and cheer for and boo for, and to, you know, I've found a little place in this business and made a little bit of a living for a little while doing it. So I'm a lucky man, I'll plug the podcast real quick. City Ringside with David Penzer on all form, anywhere that you could find
on your favorite
podcasts are found. Yeah. Sorry about that. Anywhere podcasts are found. And we drop on Monday mornings, and sort of the same kind of thing as what you do. And I listen to you, and you do a great job as well. And I'm honored that you would have me on. We're going to have to get you on City Ringside here one of these days, and you can tell your story.
Yeah,
and I'd love to hear it. And my thing is, like, you know, my back in the day, as you know, Sean, you know, there was no internet. There was no internet. There was no, you know, XM
cable,
radio.
It's just starting,
so,
and it's embassy,
yeah,
embassy,
so,
yeah.
So when we drove from one town to another, you know, we told stories, you know, and I got to hear some of the greatest wrestlers of all time tell me stories.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I have a guest on, I like to hear their story about how they got involved and their passion and stuff like that. But then tell some stories, just like try to put the fans in the car. In that car that, you know, I got to be in, because, you know, that I got to do that, and that was an honor. And so we try to, it's mostly kind of what we're doing here today. And like I said, I really appreciate you having me on. I shouldn't say this, it's kind of embarrassing, but I used to pretend that I was the host of the event center.
Wow.
When I was younger, you know, I would make up a card in my mind, and I would do the event center. So maybe that's how I got a little bit of practice, but, so it's an honor speaking to you, and, you know, glad that you found life after wrestling. Cause the business could suck you in there, but, it's a wonderful thing, and I'm just so happy to have been a part of it.
Yeah. You mentioned real estate, boy, you probably look at that, the business, go, this is nothing compared to what I used to do. So your persistence, I'm sure, pays off there, but we've also run into each other. Yeah, go ahead.
Actually, Sean, I got to tell you, as crazy as the wrestling business was, the real estate business is 10 times worse.
Yeah, I know. I've got a brother who's in real estate. Yeah, it's not easy, that's for sure. But we've run into
10 times worse.
Yeah, we've run into each other at a couple of these StarCast events that Conrad Thompson puts together, and also we're watching AEW evolve. And I wanted to get your thoughts quickly on what you've seen so far, if it's impressed you, and what you think might be the future ahead for this new AEW startup.
Well, it's caught fire like nothing else that I've seen since WCW. I will say that. I'm not comparing it to WCW. You know, as I say, they're off to a hell of a start. Excuse my French. The pay-per-view that they did, Double or Nothing, was awesome product, and I really, really, really loved the the Dustin and Cody match. And the funny thing is I had predicted, because normally brother versus brother, or like longtime tag team partner versus longtime tag team partner, doesn't really work that well for whatever reason. So I was a little bit disappointed that it was going to be those two. Boy, did I have to eat crow the next week on my podcast. Boy, was I wrong. that was one of the better matches I've seen probably in 15 years. And it left a tear in my eye because, you know, at the end, the promo that Cody cut to Dustin was sort of like my favorite Dusty Rhodes promo from leading up to Clash of the Champions, wanting Dustin to be his partner against Terry Funk and Arn Anderson. And he said, "Oh, I don't need a contract. I don't need a signature. All I need is a hug and a kiss to seal the deal, baby." And it was sort of the same. So it brought back a lot of memories because I was there live for that. And that's my favorite Dusty promo of all time. And so I texted Keith Mitchell, executive producer of WCW when I worked there, and also of TNA, and now is of AEW. And I texted him and I said, "Dusty would be very proud right now," because he was very good friends with Dusty. He said he sure would be. He'd have a big smile on his face, and he does wherever he is. So, but yeah, they're on fire. And, you know, it's one thing to do quality pay-per-views, but you know, they're going to have to put out one or 2 hours of episodic television, and that's not easy, but they got a hell of a head start, Sean. So, you know, they got the people behind them. They got the finances behind them. They got, ironically, TNT. That's another thing. I texted Keith Mitchell and I said, who'd ever thought, what a square of the circle, so to speak, of, you know, you're coming back to and being executive producer for a television show on TNT. Strange business. And, you know, in this business, they say you can never say never. Right. These guys have a good thing going. They got good, strong backing. They got a great production team behind them. And they got people's attention. So you can't ask for anything more. Now they just have to go out and execute it and keep people interested. And if they could do that, it's going to be an interesting little ride.
Yeah. And you mentioned Dusty, and I'm sure, as you said, he's proud of his son. And I mean, I am impressed with Cody and the Young Bucks. And the thing is, though, can they keep this going? You know, the one thing that's awesome about it is the fact that it's just this group of professionals who are in control of their own destinies. And you were in the green room with those people. And it was just a really awesome feeling because they're having fun. And I just hope it doesn't become corporate and egos don't get involved, and because it can be really, really awesome. And I just hope they keep it going right now. It's just great. It's great to be a part of it and see it all happen.
Well, I think everybody that's not in Connecticut probably is rooting for them to succeed because it's better. I mean, it's better for the guy, for the boys. It's better for the fans. Yeah. Competition is better. You know, it'll be better for WWE at the end. They'll have to find a way to get more creative and find a way to you know, do what they did when WCW sort of took a right turn onto their path, and they totally recreated themselves. And it'd be interesting to see if they have to recreate themselves again, how they do it, and if they could do it twice. But it'll be fun. I think, you know, heck, you know more than I do. WWE is an international global machine. So, you know, I don't think they're going anywhere, but, you know, they got a little pressure on them, from, like you said, a bunch of guys that, are having a blast paving their own way, getting to do it their style.
Yeah.
You know, the way that they want to do it.
Yeah, that's great. All right, folks, it's, Sitting Ringside with David Penzer. Check out the podcast. Dave, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Sure, they can follow me at Twitter at David Penzer. I like to interact, just talk wrestling and don't get involved in all the controversial stuff, politics and all that. I leave that for the pundits and just talk wrestling on Twitter. So if you haven't signed up, join me and let's have some fun. And Sean, thank you again for having me on. We're going to get you on for sure. And I'm going to look like a copycat now, but you've been on my short list for a while. And we want to let you tell your story, and it'd be interesting to hear both of the podcasts when we finally could get you on for sure.
Awesome. Thanks, Dave.